Welcome to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. This is a recording from the monthly Oldie Literary Lunch at the National Liberal Club. To book a ticket, please go to www.theoldie.co.uk/lunches. Many of you might have seen our next speaker, David Hepworth, on telly at the weekend, because it was 40 years since the great concert of Live Aid, and they showed the whole thing on telly, and there was David presenting it alongside Mark Ellen, the Oldies, Golden Oldies correspondent. David was a presenter of the Old Grey Whistle Test, edited Smash Hits, founded Q Magazine and Just 17, but the best thing he did was he married my teacher, who I always think of as Miss Elliot when I was eight, now Mrs. Hepworth, sitting next to me now, who taught me everything, so if there's anything wrong in the Oldie, have a word with her. But David is here to talk about his new book, Hope I Get Old Before I Die, How Rock's Greatest Generation Kept Going to the End. Ladies and gentlemen, David Hepworth.
Thank you. I'll start by saying I have no embarrassment whatsoever in urging you to buy my book. I'm going to offer a further allure here. It's delightful to be with the Oldie on this occasion. And I have to say, of all the many speaking engagements I've had at literature festivals and so forth, this first time during the pre-dinner drinks when I met somebody who headlined the Hammersmith Odeon, yes, and climaxed the act by having the entire fee for that evening's performance sprinkled among the crowd with a predictable consequence. And if you want to know who that is, if you buy my book, I'll tell you later on, okay? I'm here to talk about rock stars. And I'm going to start with a story from 39 years ago, pretty much a day like today. I was backstage at Madison Square Garden in New York, contemplating the Herculean task of interviewing Bob Dylan. Okay? And Bob Dylan, who by then had already been 20 years the kind of gold standard of a charismatic rock star, which he continues to do to this day. There are days that Bob wants to talk, and there are other days when Bob doesn't want to talk. Guess which one this was. The loudest sound in the dressing room that day was the beads of sweat dropping from my forehead and landing on the floor. Thankfully, there was a pause in proceedings, during which the woman from the record company said, "How do you think it's going, Bob?" And he said, "I don't know, he keeps asking me questions." And we could all laugh at that, but there's a great truth about that, because if any of you were in a room with Bob Dylan, you would instantly find you had no questions to ask whatsoever, actually. You didn't want to hear him sing. This is what you want to do with rock stars, okay? You want to get close enough to look at them, yes? Because they've been your fantasy friend since you were 14 years old. But during that long period, you've never been close enough to just watch them doing something really mundane. What would you rather do? Watch Mick Jagger lead the Rolling Stones at Wembley, or go and watch Mick Jagger make breakfast? I think in my case, whoever the latter, and they're probably the same in your case. The thing about rock stars, people always think they're creations of some Svengali figure behind the scenes. That's not true at all. They're creations of themselves. They've invented themselves. And very often they invented themselves long before they were famous. So long before Elvis Presley made his first record, he was known around Memphis as that guy with the dyed black hair who can't pass a mirror without combing his hair. Long before Boy George had taken over America in an explosion of androgyny and rasta clothing and so forth, he used to sit in the window of a shop in Carnaby Street, round the corner from my office, looking absolutely indistinguishable from the figure who was world famous 2 years later. This weekend, we've seen at Heaton Park in Manchester, Liam Gallagher of Oasis take the stage. I don't know if you've seen the pictures. Wearing enough anoraks to take you all the way up Helvellyn, yes? during a heat wave. Why? Because his fans would be deeply annoyed if he didn't look like the Liam Gallagher that they've always expected. Now, sometimes assuming a persona can lead to embarrassment. I'll give you an example of this. In 1977, I was driving the then barely known Elvis Costello to a radio interview. And nobody knew anything about Elvis Costello. They kept it that way. His manager wanted it that way. And so I was just talking to him about this, that, and the other. And God knows how, but I somehow, in talking about the old days of the Light programme, plucked from the recesses of my memory the name of a particular singer who really offended me when I saw him on television at the NME poll winners concert. And I said, do you remember a bloke called Ross McManus? What a pillock he was, I said, not knowing that Ross McManus was Elvis Costello's father. Elvis gave a wan grin, you know, because he couldn't complain about it, because he'd hidden where he'd come from, you know. And I see Elvis Costello once every 10 years nowadays, and he looks at me and I look at him, and he knows that I know, and I know that he knows that I know, you know. But we keep the secret. So people always ask about rock stars, what are they really like? Which always seems a shame that you have to answer that question, because since they've spent all their waking hours trying to project an idea of what they're like. You know, what's Paul McCartney like? Well, he's a people pleaser. And there's no greater example of this than the fact that when Paul McCartney comes up from his farm in Sussex, he does so on the train. Without a minder, he gets on the train, comes from Peasmarsh up to Victoria, because he likes the idea of people recognising him. He loves the idea of posing for pictures and being a man of the people. Van Morrison, on the other hand, is the polar opposite. I give you an idea of how little a people pleaser Van Morrison is. One of the songs he wrote very early in his career was about a street in Belfast called Cypress Avenue. Wonderful song. And this became so celebrated over the years, eventually the good fathers of Belfast invited him back to play a concert on Cypress Avenue. They cleared it, you know, put a stage there. All the local worthies were there. All the world's media were there. What a promotion for Belfast. Van Morrison takes to the stage, plays a whole set. What's the only song he doesn't play? That's Van Morrison. Bruce Springsteen is a control fanatic, yes? Bruce Springsteen, in his early days when he was not known to anybody, he was tired of being in bands called Steel Mill and Earth, he came back from a holiday and he said to the rest of the band, I want you to imagine how much nerve this takes to tell the rest of the band this. Henceforth, this group will be known as Bruce Springsteen and the E String Band. I'm in charge, yes? And then, from then on, they started noticing that when they began to play Monopoly, those were in the days when bands played Monopoly, he always demanded the top hat as the token for going around the board. Hence the word, you know, the boss, which is what he's still known as to this day. Now, the whole construct of being a rock star is not, they're not entirely to blame. We're to blame as well. It's not them, it's us. We demand something of them. We want to go and see them 50 years later to kind of convince ourselves that sort of we're still young, you know, and that the great, Bono always says this, the great value of a U2 concert is just when they walk on stage and the audience just go, ah, there they are. Once more together. And we always think, with a rock star, we always think, if I went for a pint with them, I would really get on with them terribly well. I don't know if that's particularly true, but it's fantasy that we like to entertain. You know, how long would you have, do you think you'd spend in the pub with Bob Geldof before he said, well, enough about me, let's talk about you. I don't know, maybe it's going to happen. Talking to Bob Geldof, so it's 40 years, as Harry said, since Live Aid on Sunday. And it's very odd thinking back, because the names, you know, the U2s, the Madonnas, the McCartneys and so forth, are still kind of current, you know, they're still of the world today. Whereas the world that came from seems to, is gone, you know. When Live Aid took place 40 years ago, you could still smoke on the London Underground. Yes, you could. You couldn't buy a cell phone, clearly, because it weren't available. And the FA Cup final, which had been played at Wembley a few weeks before, contained only one player from overseas. Okay, it's a completely different world. But a lot of things started with Live Aid. I can remember seeing Paul McCartney going up to the stage, and look, there he is, venerable old figure from Rock's Mount Rushmore. Can he get up on stage? He was 43. And he was the elder generation. And there begins the world that has climaxed this last week. I don't know if you noticed the pictures of Sir Mick Jagger and Sir Elton John being wheeled out to impress Macron at Windsor Castle, wearing, you know, top hat and tails and so forth. That whole world starts there, starts at Live Aid. And that is pretty much what my book is about. Well, one more plug for the book. It starts with Live Aid. It's about what's happened since then. I'll tell you one story about Live Aid that I don't tell on broadcast outlets because there might be a scandal. And I was sitting at one point up in the kind of old Deslinum Perspex box that used to be suspended in the eaves of the old Wembley Stadium. Does anybody remember that? And I was in there with Billy Connolly, and we were watching The Pretenders. And The Pretenders at that point had lost not one but two members to drug-fueled misadventures. And Billy Connolly looked at them as they were playing, and he said, leaned towards me, he says, "I wouldn't join that group." And I said, "Why not?" He says, "Nobody leaves." So, I wouldn't like you to think you've just heard my opinion. I'll leave you with three facts, okay? Because, you know, and if you want further explanation of this, again, come and buy a copy of my book and I'll happily give you a further explanation. You know, the greatest 45 RPM single ever made is Chuck Berry's You Never Can Tell. It's as simple as that. Don't argue about it. The most revolutionary long-playing record is the Beatles' Hard Day's Night. It's as simple as that. Don't embarrass yourself by arguing about it. Okay? And the greatest year to be born, the winning ticket on the lottery of life, as far as pop music is concerned, is 1950. That's the year I was born. Anybody else like to claim that year as well? Play it here. Okay. Thanks very much for listening to me. Cheers.
You have been listening to Radio Oldie, brought to you by Bailey Gifford. Why not get three trial issues of the Oldie magazine for just £1? Sure you'll enjoy it. We'll then charge you £25.75 for every six issues. Just go to checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial" as one word in capitals. That's checkout.theoldie.co.uk/offers and enter "old trial".